Okay, good morning, everybody. This is about 2:41, and it is September 11th. And we're probably going to finish up chapter 6 today, maybe, and maybe not, I'm not sure, but I certainly hope so. And then next week, we have two lectures on chapter 3, and then you have your first lecture exam. All right, and that's going to be on a Monday. So what is that, a week and a half from today? Oh, not a Monday, it's a Tuesday. Yeah, thank you. It's Tuesday. Thank you so much. Okay, and that's 1, 2, 3, and 6. That's what's on the exam. So, anybody have any questions regarding the schedule? I think you're all good with the schedule. That's not too complicated. All right, so any questions on material that we covered last time? I'd like to review maybe just a tiny little bit. We looked at osmosis. What are the three criteria that something has to obey in order for it to be considered osmosis? What are three things? Solvent. It's got to be a solvent molecule. Yeah. And in us, what's the solvent molecule? Water. And that's why a lot of people say osmosis is water, because it's the solvent molecule. But in other systems, it could be other kinds of molecules. But in us, indeed, it's water. All right. So what about water? What about water? It's water on the move, right? It's water moving someplace. That's what we're interested in for osmosis, the movement of water. How is it going to move? Yeah, just by itself. No energy. And how can that happen? What is driving that process? Okay. And how does diffusion work? That's really kind of the same question. Molecules will diffuse, they will move based on concentration gradient. There's got to be two locations where there's a high concentration of something, another separate location which is a lower concentration. And so how do those molecules move? By diffusion, then, from high to low or from low to high? Yeah, from high to low, right? All right, so that's two criteria. It's got to be only the water molecule that we're concerned with, and water's got to go from high concentration to low. And then what's the third thing? Semi-permeable membrane, or if you want to say selectively permeable, that works too. Right? Now, when we say moving from high concentration to low concentration only, that's kind of a loaded term, because that's, and somebody said, well, that's really diffusion, and you're right, but diffusion is kind of a loaded term as well, because we have to think in terms of energy. If it goes from high to low, if it's diffusion, does it require energy? That's just something that you've memorized and you know it does not require energy. Diffusion does not require energy, and because diffusion does not require energy, neither does osmosis, because osmosis is just a special case of diffusion. Right? Okay, so that was good. So we looked at those membranes. Remember, a particle is osmotically active if it can't get through the membrane. If only water can get through the membrane, then that molecule that's stuck in one location, we say, is osmotically active. And it exerts tonicity on a cell, and it can, depending on water concentration, a cell can hemolyze, or it could stay the same, or it could crenate. All depends on the water concentration outside the cell. So if a cell stays the same size when you put it in some of that solution, what can you tell me about that solution if nothing happens to the cell? It's isotonic, right? And then when you have your patients, that's exactly the kind of concentration you would like to give them, because you don't want to hurt any of those cells. But if you were to take a cell and put it in pure water, what would happen? 100% water outside the cell, maybe 99% inside the cell. What's going to happen? From high to low? That is, okay, if it's high, water is high outside the cell, low inside. Remember, water will go from high concentration to low, so it will go from outside the cell to inside. That means the cell has to swell up, and then it's going to blow up. We call that hemolysis. Yeah. And that solution that will hemolyze something is a hypotonic solution. Hypotonic. Okay. Something that will crenate, shrink up the cell, it will draw water out of the cell. We call that crenation, and a hypertonic solution will do that. All right. So you might want to look at your notes a little bit, because I drew that on the board. Maybe you took some notes on that. Check that out one more time. Your book talks about it pretty well. Got some exercises in Blackboard as well. Okay, then we talked about not just passive processes that move things around, like diffusion, facilitated diffusion. We talked about certain processes that can actually move things the other way, not just from high concentration to low, but can actually move things from low concentration to high. And those are what we call active transport. If it's active transport, what else does that process require? Yeah, it requires energy. Think of ATP as energy, right? And so that would be active transport. If it's using ATP directly, then that would be primary active transport. So on the slide that I'm showing you right here, let me show you on both sides of the room. Okay, so this illustration that we're looking at right here, I see, oh, you need some camera, you need some projectors, thank you. And guess what, here's a sign-in sheet. I'm glad you mentioned that to me. So the cameras are turning on. The picture that you will see is a picture of the sodium-potassium pump. I don't know if you have a picture of that in your notes, but it's going to appear pretty soon. It's a special kind of protein embedded in a membrane, which you will see in a second. And that membrane separates inside the cell from outside the cell. And I think while the projectors are turning on, you should be able to tell me something about that membrane. What is one important characteristic of that membrane that's now appearing for you? I would like to know something about its physical chemistry, some chemical properties about with that membrane. Right? We say it's separating the outside from the inside, but some things can actually go across the membrane. It's not a really good separator, but other things cannot move across the membrane, and in that case, it's a real good separator. So what can move across the membrane, and why? Nonpolar compounds, lipid oily compounds, because look at this big space in the interior of the membrane. Those are fatty acids, so that's a big nonpolar region. So only nonpolar compounds can move across the membrane by themselves. Polar compounds cannot. Polar compounds are always going to be kept outside unless they're brought into the cell with some kind of process. And an ion. We can consider an ion a polar compound because it likes to associate with water because of the electrical charge on it. So ions cannot move across the membrane by themselves either. It can't get through this oily region on the inside, the lipid part of the phospholipid bilayer. Okay, so what I wanted you to see on this side, because we're talking about active and passive processes, right, what do you see on this slide that gives you a really good hint if this is active or passive? ATP, that's right. ATP, remember, is an energy source. When it's hydrolyzed, that bond releases energy to this protein, and this protein then, since it's receiving energy from ATP, what can this protein do? It can do work, right? Because that's what energy is. The energy gives somebody the ability to do work, or a process the ability to do work. And what would be work? Right? Think of work this way. You could be down here on the stage, or you could be up there by the door. What would, in this case, let's just think in relative terms, what would require more work? Coming down the stairs or walking up the stairs? Yeah, walking up the stairs. As a matter of fact, even if you didn't have any energy whatsoever and you were at the top of the stairs, somebody would just give you a little nudge, and what would happen? Even without any energy at all, you would just roll down the stairs. Okay? So going up the stairs requires energy, that would be active. Coming down is passive. And we can think of the concentration gradient the same way. We see concentration gradients on this slide. The bold, large letters represent a high concentration, and the unbolded, smaller letters represent a lower concentration. So we now know if this is an active or passive process. So here we have potassium going from low concentration to high. That does not happen automatically. Diffusion does not work that way. Sodium goes from low concentration to high. Diffusion can't make that happen. It has to be an active process. And then furthermore, you told me there's ATP. That is the energy source for this protein right here. And since ATP is used directly, we call this primary active transport. So if you see something going from low to high, you know it's active. If you see ATP, then it is primary active transport. All right, so we have this gradient of chemicals. Right? Oh, this is why I wanted to show you this slide. These are ions, which means that they are chemicals and there's a concentration gradient, but since they're an ion, they have something else. What do they have? They're electrolytes. They have an electrical charge, right? So not only are the chemicals moving, but that electrical charge is going as well, and an electrical charge in motion is what we call a current. And if there's a separation in charge, if there's different charges that are separated by something, then there's a gradient in electrical charge. And I think we talked about typically what do we call when there's something that can separate electrical charges, like put positive stuff over here, negative stuff over here. We call that a battery, right? And what can you tell me about those different charges? Do they repel each other or do they attract? They attract each other, right? So then they would neutralize each other. All right, so if we have the sodium-potassium pump, the thing to remember is that there are three sodiums that leave the cell for every two that enter. All right, so if it was three and three, then there would be no electrical difference across the membrane, because as soon as three positive charges left, three would go in, but that's not the case. Three positive charges leave, but only two enter. So what happens to the inside of the cell? It doesn't get as many positive charges, right, as what leaves. So the inside of the cell becomes more negative as a result compared to the outside. And so you could consider the cell membrane as like being a battery, and that difference in charge can be used to do work. It's a concentration gradient of electrical charge, and that can be used to do work. So here we have glucose going up the stairs, and as opposed to going down the stairs. So would that be an active or passive process when glucose goes up the stairs? It's active. It requires what? Energy of some kind. Do you see ATP being used in this scheme? No ATP. So it cannot be primary active transport. It is the secondary active transport. But where does that energy come from? It comes from a concentration gradient of an electrolyte, sodium. And if sodium moves down the stairs, that energy can be used to move glucose up the stairs. So these two processes have to be coupled with each other. What makes sodium a high concentration in one area and low in another is dependent on ATP. So you have to have primary active transport before secondary active transport can actually operate inside of a cell. All right, so if you see ATP, it's primary. See no ATP, secondary, as long as it's not diffusion. Okay, so I wanted to go over that because that helps describe this slide right here. Make sure you understand this slide really, really well. All right, so where did that take us last time? Bulk transport. We're almost done with transport. Bulk transport is another special kind of active transport. All right, so here we see the surface of the cell, right, forming a dimple, and then things, we call that maybe an invagination, and we see particles in the extracellular fluid, and they can just float into this dimple on the cell, that invagination, and then microtubules can actually move the membrane around and close off this dimple and make it a vesicle, and then move the vesicle into the cytoplasm. And then stuff that was in the extracellular fluid are now where? Are they outside the cell or inside the cell? They're inside the cell in their own little compartment inside this vesicle. So this is another way of bringing material into the cell through the cell membrane that couldn't by themselves do that. And this example is because these particles are too big. Right, but it might be for other reasons as well. Maybe there's an electrical charge, or maybe they're polar, or other kinds of things. The process that moves material from outside to inside, okay, is called endocytosis. And there are two kinds of endocytosis I'm sure you're familiar with. Does anybody remember what the two kinds of endocytosis are? There's cell eating and cell drinking. What do we call cell eating? Phagocytosis. Phago is to eat. Cytosis is a cellular process, right? And cell drinking is pinocytosis. Pinocytosis is cell drinking. They're just special conditions of endocytosis. Well, the opposite can take place. Here we can have a vesicle with junk on the inside of it. That junk can't get outside the cell by itself because it's too big or too polar. And microtubules can move that vesicle over to the cell membrane. And notice that the membrane of the vesicle is exactly the same as the membrane of the cell. So they will fuse together very easily. And then whatever contents that were inside that vesicle are in this dimple because it opens up. And then they're released from the cell. That would be a really good example of secretion. And secretion is an exocytosis process. Exocytosis just means going from inside to outside the cell. And of course, you should know if bulk transport is passive or active. Make sure you can answer that. What would be your first guess? Takes a lot of energy to move that vesicle around. Okay, so it's active, right? It's an active transport process because you actually got to pull and push on that membrane, right, to form that invagination. The vesicle's got to move from one location to another. That just doesn't happen automatically. All right. Okay, next topic is going to be membrane potential. Well, you kind of know what a membrane is, right? It's that phospholipid bilayer. And potential is just another way of saying voltage. And so we could also call this the membrane voltage, but we got to review maybe what a voltage is. What is a voltage? How do you talk about a voltage? Voltage just means that there's a difference in electrical charge from one area to another. There's a gradient in electrical charge. And we measure that in terms of volts. And if there are two locations at different electrical charges, right, we can consider that a battery. And we would say that has voltage across it. If there's no voltage across it, right, if there are no volts, if both sides of the membrane have the same voltage, then it's not acting like a battery. There's no separation in charge. And if it was a battery, what would we call that battery? If we looked at a battery and we measured the voltage across the two ends of a battery and there was none, they were exactly the same, what would we call that battery? We would call that dead. Same thing for cells. There has to be a voltage across the membrane. And these voltages develop because there are electrolytes in our body, sodium, potassium, chlorine, all these other things. All right, so what devices do you own that contain a voltage? Batteries. And, right, and how many terminals does a battery have? It has two. And they're going to be at a different voltage, right? One will be more positive compared to the other one, or you could say one will be more negative compared to the other one. Same thing. All right, so let's look at membrane potential. So you probably realize that it is really important, these electrical properties of every cell, because every cell acts like a battery. All right, let's work with this diagram right here. And as a matter of fact, I think I'm going to draw some stuff on the board, because I want to go back even a little bit further. And maybe if you can watch how I draw it out, it might make a lot of sense to you. All right, and we're going to start with a lot of stuff you know. So here we have a membrane surrounding this. We could call that a cell if we want, right? And if we have a lot of potassium outside the cell and no potassium inside the cell, and let's just say this potassium can get across the membrane. The membrane is, we say, permeable to potassium. Is potassium going to be on the move? Yes or no first? Yeah, okay, because there are two areas with a concentration gradient, concentration difference. So how do things move? From high concentration to low, potassium is high outside the cell and it's low, right? It's zero inside the cell. So sodium will have, okay, will move inside the cell based on concentration gradient. Right, the gradient of potassium. Right. And then when will this diffusion stop? Or will it just keep going forever? Will all the potassiums in the world end up inside the cell? No, they won't. When will it stop? When they are exactly the same. Right. So now we have potassium exactly the same concentration. And so there's no concentration gradient. It's going to stop. All right, so let's take that system and let's modify it a little bit. What can you tell me about two positive charges? Do they attract or repel? They repel each other. All right, nice. What about two negative charges? They repel each other. What about a positive and a negative charge? They attract each other, right? Boom, like so. Okay, they attract each other. All right, so now let's take this cell right here with equal concentrations of potassium, and let's put a bunch of negative charges in here. And this is what happens to all your cells. We have a lot of proteins inside these cells, and it just so happens these proteins have a negative charge on them. So let me put a bunch of negative charges right here. All right. And we started with what? This much potassium. And we started with this much potassium outside the cell. Oh, there's two of them. Okay, and I'll put another one over here, like so. So we started with potassium equal concentration across the cell. Diffusion stops, right, because there's no concentration gradient. Now let's put some negative charges inside the cell. Are these potassium going to want to move in one direction or another? They're equal concentration, but look at these laws here. The protein is negative, potassium is positive, right? So this negative charge right here is going to draw additional potassium inside the cell because potassium is a positive to help neutralize these negatives. So what's going to happen? Let's just say a number of potassiums now enter the cell to help neutralize these negative charges. So now what can you tell me about potassium concentration? Is it exactly equal? It's more potassium inside the cell, and it's drawn in by that negative electrical charge. Tell me what would happen if I take that negative charge away, starting here. What would happen? Yeah, the potassium would leave the cell. Okay. So there are two things that move potassium across the membrane. One, we said, was the concentration gradient, and the other one is this electrical gradient. The electrical gradient. So as the concentration gradient increases with potassium entering the cell, then that's going to force potassium out, because remember, diffusion is powered by concentration gradient. But these negative charges pull in potassium, so what's going to win out? Is all the potassium going to be here, or all the potassium going to be here, or is there going to be an unequal potassium concentration across the membrane? All the potassium won't end up inside the cell, okay? And because of diffusion, it's not going to leave. There has to be a balance between these two gradients, electrical gradient and concentration gradient. So in this particular case, what is pushing potassium out of the cell? What's pushing it out? Okay. I want this just to be a passive process, just passive. So let's not use ATP. Just a passive process. What's trying to kick this potassium out of the cell? Yeah, here is a lot of potassium, high concentration, here is low. Right, and diffusion just goes from high to low. So potassium is going to want to leave, but there's also another process that is drawing potassium in. What is that process? The electrical gradient is bringing potassium in to the cell. So when these two things are balanced out, then there will no longer be any movement of potassium. But because of these negative charges, you're going to end up with a higher concentration of potassium inside the cell compared to outside. They will only be the same if what? If we get rid of that electrical gradient and go back to this condition here. And who can tell me where these negative charges come from? They come from proteins that you have inside the cell. And we make proteins all the time. All right, so let's look at the PowerPoint slides now. So here we have that nice cell, and we've got some molecules that are electrolytes because you can see a charge. The fixed anions are those proteins. Remember, what kind of charge does an anion have? Negative, right? It has a negative charge. You can see that charge right there. All right. And so what's going to happen? What's going to draw positive charges into this cell? Okay. These ions, these negative charges, right? The negative charges are going to bring these positive charges inside the cell. But that's going to change the concentration gradient of these molecules. So now you have a higher concentration inside the cell than out. So things will want to diffuse from high concentration to low. But eventually, an equilibrium will be established to where the amount of potassium entering or leaving the cell is exactly the same. But nonetheless, there's still going to be more potassium inside the cell because of these negative charges. All right, so membrane potential is a difference in electrical charge. We see that you have more electrical charges, right, inside the cell compared to the outside, and that is due to these fixed ions inside the cell. And that's how it happens. And we did not use any ATP to do that. That voltage just automatically appears, just like these membranes sort of automatically appear. That's sort of amazing and magical. So think of two forces that move ions across the membrane, the concentration gradient and the electrical gradient. And if there's a gradient in charge, that's an attraction, right? If they're opposite charges, there is an attraction. And we only considered, for instance, like potassium. Okay, so at some point in time, the concentration of potassium is going to equalize. It's not going to move one way or the other, right? But there'll be more inside the cell because of the negative charges. We can calculate what the concentration difference is between potassium inside and outside the cell in order for these two forces, right, the electrical gradient pulling in, concentration gradient kicking out. We can, at equilibrium, we can then calculate what the electrical difference across the membrane is going to be. And we call that the equilibrium potential. And it's not going to be neutral. And we can measure that with a voltmeter. Here's a voltmeter. We put one end of the voltmeter inside the cell, the other end of the voltmeter outside the cell, and we don't see 0 volts. We see some 90 millivolts, which is a little voltage, but cells are little. That's a pretty good number. Well, for just potassium. And we're going to see how we can calculate that in just a little bit. And remember, you could use this voltmeter to measure the voltage on a battery. And if the needle moves, then you would say the battery is not dead. It's charged with electrical charge. Same thing for this particular cell. Okay, so how do we calculate what this equilibrium potential is? And remember, potential is the same thing as voltage. Because you have more charges inside compared to the outside of the cell, here is the equation. And it's called the Nernst equation. E sub x just means the equilibrium potential due to a particular electrolyte. So what could you put in here for x if we are thinking about an electrolyte? What could we put in there? We can substitute other things for x. What are some things we could substitute x for? We could put in sodium, right? Any kind of ion or electrolyte we could put here. So this could be E sub Na, or E sub K, or E sub calcium, because calcium is an ion as well. All right, so this value depends on just the concentration gradient, the ratio of ion concentrations inside and outside the cell membrane. And X can only be one ion. It can't be all of the ions inside your body. This equation works only for one ion at a time. So if this is sodium up here in the numerator, this has to be sodium down here in the denominator. We can't combine. Or if this is sodium in the numerator, you can't put calcium and chloride and potassium in the denominator, right? It's got to be exactly the same. So then we take the log of that to the base 10. You got a button on your calculator that will do that. And then you got to multiply this entity by 61 divided by Z. And Z is the valence of ion X. So how would we talk about sodium? What's the valence of sodium? It would be a monovalent cation, right? So if it's a monovalent cation, what would we put in for Z here? We would put in a plus 1. Yeah, plus 1. And what is 61 divided by 1? It's 61, right? So that's not too difficult. But what if it was calcium that has a plus 2? It has a valence of 2. Then this X would be plus 2, and we'd have to take 61 and divide it by 2 and multiply by this result. All right, chlorine, does anybody know what kind of charge chlorine has on it? talked about a little bit. It's negative. How many negatives? One, two, three, four. Yeah, it's a monovalent anion. So Z in that particular case, if this was chlorine, Cl, that would be minus one. So you put a minus one for Z. What would you have to multiply the log of these concentrations by? Not just 61. Well, it's one. You don't have to divide anything, but you got to multiply by negative. Then you would put a minus 61 right here. Right, so you just plug in that valence into Z and use your calculator to calculate it. So that takes us to this particular slide. I see four different electrolytes here, four different ions, and you should be able to talk about these: sodium monovalent cation, potassium monovalent, chlorine monovalent anion, calcium bivalent or divalent cation. And here is a cell, and I don't want you to memorize these numbers, but I do want you to memorize where these chemicals are at a high concentration. Are they high inside the cell? Are they higher outside the cell? Or are they equal across the cell membrane? Because that's going to be a basis for your understanding for a lot of things. So let's look at sodium first. Where is sodium at a high concentration? Inside or outside? It's outside, right? So just kind of memorize that. In a normal resting cell, sodium is going to be high on the outside. What about potassium? It's going to be high on the inside of the cell. You can always count on that if the cell is at rest. And chlorine, look at this. We haven't talked about this yet, but look at chlorine. Is it equal across the membrane? No, it's a lot higher outside. Okay, it's a lot higher outside because it doesn't want to move in so much because the cell is already negative on the inside, and chlorine is negative by itself, right? So it doesn't have a lot of reason to move inside the cell. And calcium, right? Calcium is almost zero inside the cell, and it's relatively high outside, right? 2.5 millimolar is a lot greater than 0.0001 millimolar. And in most cells at rest, calcium is going to be zero. Small changes in calcium concentration can cause big changes in the physiology of a cell. And that's because calcium is almost zero inside the cell. So we can calculate the membrane potential produced by the sodium ion by itself, the potassium ion by itself, the chlorine by itself, or the calcium all by itself, using what? The Nernst equation right here. And you got to practice that a little bit. Every calculator is different, so I want you to practice with the calculator that you're going to bring in on the test to make sure you know how to divide two numbers, right? You divide the numbers first. Then you hit the log button. You got to make sure you know where the log button is. Some calculators have two. They have a natural log and a log to the base 10. You want to use the log to the base 10, not the LN, but the LOG button. And then multiply that result by 61 divided by whatever this valence is. And that would tell you the equilibrium potential. That would tell you, right, knowing the concentration gradient across the membrane, what the gradient in voltage is across the membrane. And that's what we call the equilibrium potential, right? So we could calculate E for potassium, E for sodium, chlorine, and for calcium. So here is the question. Which ions are at a high concentration inside the cell? Which ones are high inside the cell? Potassium. Is that the only one? As a matter of fact, it's true. That's the only one that's higher inside the cell compared to the outside. Which one is high on the outside? Sodium is? Potassium, 5 versus 150 on the inside. No, not potassium. What about chlorine? Yes, high on the outside compared to the inside. And what about calcium? It's high on the outside. A resting cell, you should probably just be familiar with that. Calcium should be really close to zero inside the cell when it's resting. All right, so here are the numbers calculated a little bit. So to use the Nernst equation, for potassium, you just look at the concentration gradient for potassium and plug that into this equation right here. We got 5 outside, 150 inside. Here it is. Take the log of that, multiply. What would you multiply the result of this, of log of 5 divided by 150 by? 61 over 1, which is just 61, and you end up with minus 90 millivolts, right, because something less than 1, if you take a log of something less than 1, it becomes a negative number, right? Okay, so this equation makes really nice, perfect sense. Right, and because the concentration of sodium is opposite compared to the concentration gradient in potassium, I would expect that the voltage would be different. All right, so we plug that in. The valence is still plus one, but the concentration gradient goes the opposite way. And a large number divided by a smaller number, and take the log of it, is always going to be positive. So positive times a positive is going to end up being a positive voltage. All right, so this is what we call the equilibrium potential produced by each one of these ions individually, but we know that all of these act together at the same time. Unfortunately, we can't just add all of these numbers together to calculate what the real voltage is across the cell, because there are some other things you have to take into account, and that is, how easy is it for these ions to move across the cell membrane? That's a different equation. But it's a better equation, but it's a little bit more complicated. So we don't have to do that here in this physiology class. So at rest, everything's at equilibrium. We could calculate what the equilibrium potential is. And that potential, with everything all added up together, all the effects of things that are causing a voltage across the membrane, we're going to call that resting membrane potential. Or we could call it resting membrane voltage. That's just the charge across the membrane, right? And it's the membrane voltage of a cell when it's not producing impulses, and that's when it is at rest, right? And impulses are mostly produced by neurons, nerve cells. The RMP, when cells at rest, for all cells, is between minus 65 and minus 85 millivolts. You don't have to know what cells or which one. We're just going to assume that the resting membrane potential pretty much of all the cells in your body is minus 70. Right. And where would that minus sign be? It would be inside the cell. Right. So inside the cell would be negative compared to outside, which is going to be relatively positive. Right. And RMP depends on concentration of ions, right? And we could use the Nernst equation to help figure that out. Right. But it also is affected by permeability. How easy is it for an ion to move across the membrane? And as a matter of fact, that concept of permeability has the greatest effect on what this membrane voltage is, and to a second degree, the concentration of ions. So we want to be interested in how these ions are moving, right? Even when the cell is at rest. Okay. So if we take into account the concentration gradient and the permeability of these ions across the membrane, right, we're just going to say that most cells are right at minus 70 millivolts. And if we look at this symbol right here, where is it going to be more negative, inside the cell or outside? Inside, right? And it's going to be more positive on the outside. Okay. The role of the sodium-potassium pump. Well, we saw before that it kicks out three sodiums and it draws in only two potassiums. So you can see, because of the sodium-potassium pump, it becomes, what, more negative inside the cell compared to outside, just because there are not equal numbers of sodium-potassium. And because of that, we call the sodium-potassium pump electrogenic, because it adds some voltage to the membrane. Electrogenic meaning that it helps produce that electrical charge across the membrane. Now, when that happens, right, what else has to happen? What's being used? Remember, potassium is going from low concentration to high. Sodium is going from low concentration to high, because now we know where sodium is high, right? Where potassium is high. What do we call it when something goes from low to high? Any kind of molecule, even water, which doesn't have an electrical charge on it. Something that goes from low to high is an active process. It's not passive. Can't happen automatically. What happens automatically? High to low. But from low to high requires energy, and we know that this pump right here requires ATP. It's not drawn in on this slide, but if you go back and look at this slide at where we first showed it to you, you saw an ATP molecule. So what kind of active transport would that be? Primary active transport. So if you want to, in your notes, draw in an ATP molecule to remind you that's primary active transport, that's fine with me. That's good. So that ATP is used to make that electrical difference across the membrane using these electrolytes right here, sodium and potassium. All right, so here are some of the things you have to consider that produce the resting membrane potential. And remember, we said it's about minus 70 millivolts. Where did we start? Well, we started by putting a lot of negative charges inside the cell, all those proteins that are inside the cell. And the cell membrane has different permeabilities to potassium and to sodium. And because of that difference in permeability, that also adds to the membrane potential. What else can add to it? The sodium-potassium pump, remember, is electrogenic. So sodium is higher on the inside. Sodium is higher on the outside because of that pump. Potassium is higher on the inside. So there's an uneven distribution of ions across the membrane. That adds some voltage to the membrane. And right, and here we can see what the equilibrium potentials are for potassium and for sodium. And if we consider all of these things, right, then we can come up with what the membrane potential is of minus 70. All right, so what's important about this slide? I want you to know something about the sodium-potassium pump, that it's electrogenic. And I also want you to know that when these ions can move across the membrane, that's going to change the resting membrane potential. If all of a sudden a lot of potassium can leak out, right, if all of a sudden a lot of potassium leaves the cell, what happens to the membrane potential? If only positive charges leave, then the inside becomes more negative, right? And all of a sudden we allow a lot of sodium inside the cell. What happens to the inside of the cell? It becomes more positive, right? So the potential changes depending on the permeability of that membrane to these ions. As a matter of fact, all ions. And we're going to get back to that in the next couple chapters, especially when we get to the nervous system. Okay, let's talk about some cell signalings. How do cells communicate with each other? Well, the concept here is a synapse. And the structural and functional unit of communication between cells is the synapse. So it has to have a special kind of structure, right, in order to have that function, in order for one cell to change the physiology inside of a neighboring cell. It's got to have a synapse. We've got two different kinds of synapses. We have electrical synapses and chemical synapses. So electrical rely on changes in voltage, right? Chemical relies on a chemical actually bumping into a cell and binding to a receptor. But it's not an electrical event. It's just a chemical event. Let's talk about the electrical synapse first. There are not very many of these in your body. Probably you heard this in anatomy. And there has to be a special connection. All right, I see two cells on this illustration. There's one on the top, one on the bottom, and they're connected together with this tunnel. And this tunnel right here is made from different proteins that go all the way across the membrane. We call those connexin proteins. And if there's a tunnel that connects these cells, we call that a gap junction. So here's a gap junction that allows the cytoplasm and one cell to communicate with the other. And it won't let all kinds of molecules through, but it will let a sodium molecule through. What can you tell me about sodium? It's a plus, right? Plus one. It's an electrolyte. All right, so at rest, these cells are not changing the voltage across the membrane. Right? It's just at minus 70. Right? If all of a sudden we put some sodium into the top cell, right, it's going to change the voltage in the top cell, but now we have high concentration of sodium in the top cell, low in the bottom, and there's a way for sodium to get across these cell membranes. What's going to happen to sodium in the cytoplasm of the bottom cell? Because it's high in the top, low in the bottom, sodium will move by diffusion to the bottom cell, and that's going to change the electrical properties of the bottom cell because sodium is an electrolyte, because it's dragging along a positive charge. Okay, so for right now, I want you to memorize that when sodium enters a cell, that is what we're going to consider an excitatory event. It's a stimulus and it causes excitation. So when sodium enters the cell, it's going to excite the cell, and if this is, and this is where we find gap junctions in the heart, if we excite cardiac muscle, how does a cardiac muscle respond when it is excited? It contracts, right? So that cardiac muscle will contract. And then the cell over here, right on the bottom, it's going to receive all that sodium. Remember that entering of sodium into the cell is an excitatory event. Then this cell down over here is going to contract. And this happens very rapidly. All right, so what this, what these gap junctions do is it makes sure that when one cell in the heart contracts, they all contract together. And that's exactly how the heart has to work. All right, the heart has to pump as a unit to pump blood out. If only one cell contracted and then another and then another and then another, blood would just kind of slosh around inside the heart. It wouldn't get pumped out into a blood vessel anywhere, right? So the heart has to contract as a unit. What about skeletal muscle? Do you think skeletal muscle should have gap junctions? Probably no. Maybe you're even kind of laughing in your mind, because if skeletal muscle have, if they had gap junctions, all you have to do is contract one muscle fiber, one cell inside your body, and what would happen? All your skeletal muscles would contract, right? That would not be useful. Couldn't go anywhere. Couldn't breathe, right? You would just be kind of quivering on the floor if you had gap junctions. So the junction between a neuron and skeletal muscle is not an electrical synapse, it's a chemical synapse. And this is sort of how the basis of chemical synapses work. In order for the receiving cell to understand that it's being signaled, it has to have a receptor. And that receptor usually is on the surface of that cell. So here we have two different kinds of cells. This top layer right here wants to communicate with the cells on the bottom, coordinate activity for the purpose of coordinating activity. And notice there are no gap junctions here, so these cells are electrically isolated from each other. Electricity will not work. So the top cells have to release a compound then that will move from high concentration to low across this space, and then it can bump into this, these cells down below. Now these cells down below will ignore that chemical unless it has what? These cells down below have to have a receptor for that particular chemical. Otherwise, they'll just ignore it. And the shape of the receptor has to be complementary to the shape of this signaling molecule. If they're different shapes, then these two things won't bind together. All right, so this is what we call a paracrine signaling. Paracrine just means that this signaling molecule moves by diffusion over short distances. And, you know, another kind of crine that moves over long distances, you're familiar with a whole bunch of these things. Like there's a gland that secretes a chemical and it goes into the blood and it travels all over the body, really long distances. And when it bumps into a cell that has a receptor, it changes the physiology of that cell. Do you know what that kind of signaling is called?
Endocrine.
That would be an endocrine. Yeah, so paracrine is short range, endocrine is long range. And the endocrine system uses blood vessels to deliver that signaling compound all through your body. All right, but we're just going to look at short range right here. All right, so what must a target cell have in order to respond to a signal molecule? It's got to have a receptor, right? So target cell and receptor are like the same concept in your mind, right? So I didn't mention that. So this is the target tissue or target cells because they have a receptor. What about these cells up here? Are these the target cells? No, they don't have receptors, right? Okay, so that's not the target tissue. What must be the shape of the binding site and the paracrine receptor? Yeah, they've got to have the same kind of shape. Okay, here is the other kind of synapse. This is a chemical synapse. And I see two different kinds of cells. I see a neuron and I see a muscle cell. Certainly, I think you can recognize these two different cells from your anatomy class, right? I see a bunch of dendrites on this this neuron, and then this one really long process that's an axon. The axon sends information down to the axon terminus in the form of an electrical signal. So electrical signals move along this axon, but there's a big space between the neuron and the muscle, and so that electrical signal can't hop across. It can't move across unless it was like a lightning bolt or something. And there's no lightning bolts in our body. So how does information get from the neuron into this muscle cell? Well, the neuron releases a chemical. That chemical moves across this space and it binds to a receptor on the muscle. And then that is converted back into an electrical signal. But through this junction right here, that's chemical. So this is an example of a chemical synapse. So how do chemical synapses work? Well, it converts an electrical signal into a chemical, which then changes that back to an electrical signal, just like that. So electrical, chemical. The substance that's being released by a neuron that transmits that information is what we call a neurotransmitter. A neurotransmitter is short range, so it's an example of a paracrine agent, right? Because it operates only short term. And as a matter of fact, there are many kinds of chemicals that are called neurotransmitters. You should be able to give me a specific name of a neurotransmitter. We'll look at these a lot in this class. And maybe you have heard of one called acetylcholine. Acetylcholine is the particular neurotransmitter that works at this neuromuscular junction, acetylcholine. And all neuromuscular junctions that are skeletal muscle use acetylcholine. And that changes the electrical properties of the skeletal muscle cell, causing it to contract. Maybe some other names of neurotransmitters you've heard of, like norepinephrine, epinephrine, serotonin, dopamine. There's a whole range of different kinds of neurotransmitters that are used for different purposes in your body. And learning about those is one of the cool things about this class. Okay, what must the shape of the binding site of the neurotransmitter, I don't know if this makes sense, what must be the shape of the binding site of the neurotransmitter receptor? How does that relate to the shape of the molecule? That's a really poorly worded sentence. They have to be complementary, right? You have to think of lock and key or hand and glove, right? And if the shape of the receptor changes, then this neurotransmitter can't bind, and then the signal is lost. It can't go across this junction, right? They have to be the same. That's what we call specificity, right? So this communication requires specificity between the neurotransmitter and the receptor. So this is what we would call a cholinergic receptor. There are other kinds of receptors for other kinds of compounds, like adrenergic receptors. They have a different shape. So if this muscle cell had an adrenergic receptor with a different shape, would acetylcholine work to excite this cell? It would not, because of specificity, right? It wouldn't bind to the adrenergic receptor. Okay. You told me everything about this slide I want to know already. Here is a chemical that's secreted from these cells, and it doesn't diffuse to a neighboring cell to bind to a receptor. It diffuses to a capillary, gets in a capillary, right, and then the blood delivers it all over the body, and then it can diffuse out of another capillary and diffuse around in your body, and when it bumps into a cell with a receptor, it will bind to that receptor and change the physiology of these cells right here. Now, these two areas of cells are far apart. Right? One could be in the brain, one could be in the pelvic cavity. They're not next to each other, like in that example of a paracrine agent. So this thing is long range. The system that does that is the endocrine system. Endocrine as opposed to paracrine. Okay? Endocrine versus paracrine, a little bit different. So let's look at the overall flow of concepts that I want you to know here. What kind of gland, and you know two different classes of glands, what kind of gland does not have a duct? It is an endocrine gland. What kind of gland has a duct? Exocrine gland, right? So there are different kinds of glands. Endocrines have no ducts, but they don't need a duct because what do they utilize to transmit what they're secreting? They use blood vessels, so they don't have to have a duct. And these blood vessels carry that signaling compound all over the body. Right, so this is what we call an endocrine gland because I don't see a duct. And this is an example of an endocrine agent because it exerts an effect far away from where the endocrine gland is. It can't happen by diffusion. All right, so an endocrine system has an endocrine gland that secretes that signaling compound into the blood, and that signaling compound is what we're going to call a hormone. So endocrine glands secrete hormones, where they move to a distant location in the body and they change the physiology of a target tissue. But what is a target tissue or a target organ? What does it have to have? Yeah, it's got to have a receptor. All right, so don't forget that. A target tissue or target organ is only a target tissue organ because it has a receptor to that particular hormone. So what must be the shape of the binding site of the hormone receptor? It's got to be complementary to the shape of the signaling compound. And here they kind of look circular. right? Okay. So this is endocrine signaling, long range. All right, here we have that cell membrane once again. What kind of compounds can move across the cell membrane? Remember, what kind of compounds? Hydrophilic or hydrophobic? The membrane is lipid, right? Phospholipid bilayer. And here's a big lipid region. So only nonpolar compounds, only hydrophobic compounds can move through this oily interior of the membrane. All right, so if the regulator is nonpolar or lipid-soluble, then it can move through this lipid layer of the membrane and enter the cell. So if that is the case, then there don't have to be receptors on the outside of the cell. The receptors are intracellular. All right, so I would say almost 100% of the time, if it is a lipid signaling compound, fatty signaling compound, then it will diffuse inside the cell, bind to a receptor there, and when it binds to a receptor inside the cell, it's going to change how proteins are produced, what kinds of proteins and how many proteins are produced in the cell. And remember, proteins have a particular structure, which means they have a particular function, so that then means that when this signaling compound binds to this receptor, it changes the physiology inside the cell, because the cell is going to make different kinds of proteins. And we're going to look at the two steps of protein synthesis. There's one step called transcription, another translation. All right, so when a lipid hormone binds to a receptor, sometimes we call that a transcription factor because that initiates that first step in protein synthesis. Here are some examples of nonpolar kinds of hormones, steroids, thyroid hormone, and even nitric oxide, which is a gas. These things can diffuse inside the cell. So for a steroid hormone, could anybody give me an example of a steroid hormone? Like I didn't quite hear. Estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, cortisol. All right, so you have a whole bunch, and these work by entering the cell and binding to a cytoplasmic receptor, and that changes protein synthesis inside that cell. Okay. Now what happens if it's, so that's a hydrophobic, right, because it can associate with lipid. What about a hydrophilic molecule? Can a hydrophilic molecule get across the membrane? Nope, because the membrane is oily, it's going to be excluded. So if that signaling compound is going to affect the physiology of the cell, where does the receptor have to be? If it was inside the cell, they could never bind with each other because that molecule can't get in. Where does that receptor have to be? On the cell membrane, on the outside of the cell. All right. So hydrophilic regulatory molecules have to have receptors on the outside of the cell. And this was a mystery for many, many years, thousands of years, okay, millions of years. But somebody figured this out not too long ago. How does a signaling molecule that is trapped outside the cell, how does it change the physiology of something inside the cell? All right. So let's just say maybe this thing is a letter, and that postman put it in your mailbox, and in order for you to read it, you got to go to the mailbox and bring it inside your house and look at it. But what would happen if nobody was there to bring the letter inside the house? The letter could never get inside the house for you to read. All right, that was a mystery. How does that information get inside the house? How does this information move across the cell membrane if the messenger can never get inside? All right, so that's what we're going to look at. Right, polar regulatory molecules bind to cell surface receptors. And the cell surface receptors will then cause the creation of second messengers inside the cell. So inside the cell, when the cell is at rest, a second messenger will be at low concentration. When this receptor is bound to this, we call that a ligand, the smaller molecule binding to this receptor, will cause an increased concentration of second messengers inside the cell, and then that will change the physiology inside the cell. So we call this signal transduction. When some kind of signaling molecule outside the cell causes the concentration of a second signaling molecule inside the cell, that's signal transduction, and that really explains how information in the first messenger can affect the physiology of the second. All right, so some second messengers. Oh, I tell you what, here's a good question. Where are first messengers always located? This is like an absolute rule. first messengers are outside the cell, and where are second messengers? Always inside the cell. Yeah, they're always going to be inside the cell. There's never a violation of that, ever. Okay, here are some examples of second messengers, things that can change the physiology inside the cell if they build up in the cytoplasm of the cell. And here's one, calcium, right? And what is in a resting cell, what's the calcium concentration? Remember I said it was zero, basically zero. If for any reason the calcium concentration inside a cell increases, then the physiology of that cell is going to drastically change because it's a type of second messenger. AMP is an ATP molecule with two phosphates chopped off, adenosine monophosphate, right? And ATP is an important energy molecule, but it can be converted into a signaling molecule if two phosphates are chopped off. But then it has to be converted into a special form of adenosine monophosphate. It has to form a cycle. It's got to form a ring structure, right? Then it can be a second messenger. That's usually at zero concentration inside cells. When a cell becomes activated, then cyclic AMP concentration usually increases. Right? AMP by itself in a linear form is different, has a different shape than cyclic AMP, and guess what? Has a different function. Regular old AMP, just linear AMP, really doesn't have much of any kind of function inside the cell. But cyclic AMP, huge difference inside the cell. Some other things that we're going to look at shortly, G proteins, right? Another chemical compound called diacylglycerate, you could just call it DAG. The concentration of DAG increases inside the cell, the physiology of the cell is going to change. And then inositol-3-phosphate, and you could just call that IPI-3. When the concentration of IPI-3 changes, then the physiology of the cell is going to change as well. I think we want to look at G proteins. All right, so G proteins are part of a second messenger pathway in many cells. All right, so what kind of signaling compound would use a G protein for signal transduction? Would it be a hydrophilic or hydrophobic molecule, signaling compound? Okay, hydrophobic, because hydrophobic can't get inside the cell. It needs some other mechanism. Because that molecule is a first messenger, it needs a second messenger inside the cell. All right, G proteins have three subunits, and these three subunits come together, and when the signaling molecule binds to the receptor, they can dissociate, they can come apart, and then they can come back together again, right? But binding to the receptor causes them to come apart, and when they become apart, that can activate other things inside the cell or in the membrane itself. That subunit can bind to an ion channel and change the permeability of that membrane to sodium. Now, what did we say when the permeability of a membrane changes to an electrolyte? What happens to the voltage across it? It changes drastically, right? So not just the concentration gradient across the membrane, but how permeable it is to that ion, right? Or this second messenger can bind to an enzyme, and it will change the activity of that enzyme. Enzyme allows for a particular chemical reaction to increase, right? So it speeds up the rate of a reaction. So something that binds to a G protein outside the cell can change the speed of chemical reactions inside of a cell, or maybe it will even inhibit a particular chemical reaction. That changes the physiology inside the cell. So here is an exam figure, and that's the last slide for this chapter. Wow, we're going to have so much extra time left over. That is good, in case you have questions. All right, so what do we see when we look at this particular illustration? Do you see a cell membrane? Do you see a cell membrane on there anywhere? Yeah. Yep, because I see a phospholipid bilayer, right? But it's not just a phospholipid bilayer. You should think of this in the fluid mosaic model, because in that membrane is a protein. That's the mosaic part of this membrane. There are other things that can be added to a protein. And notice that it goes all the way across the cell membrane. Where do you find the receptor? On the outside of the cell, the extracellular space. It's not really drawn in very well on this slide. It goes all the way across, and then here is the intracellular space. So here we have the regulatory molecule binding to a receptor. All right, so this is the receptor. What can you tell me about the shape of this regulatory molecule and the receptor? They got to match up, right? They got to be complementary to each other. If one's a hand, the other's got to be a glove. Right? If one's a lock, the other one's got to be a key. They got to fit together. The structure has to be just right. Okay, then what happens? Here are the three protein subunits. Okay, that's alpha, beta, and gamma. Usually that's what we count. Gamma, usually we call that as like the third one or the end of something. These proteins are all together sitting on this particular receptor. And when this regulatory molecule binds to the receptor, what did we say? We say these things dissociate from each other. They unbind. They unlock. So when this regulatory molecule binds to the receptor, it's like poking that receptor with a finger, right? And that receptor is going to change shape, and that shape goes across the membrane, and it's going to cause the dissociation of this triplex into a beta-gamma subunit and an alpha subunit. The alpha subunit has a binding site for an energy molecule. What's the energy molecule you're really familiar with? ATP. Here's another one that's a cousin molecule. It's called guanosine triphosphate. Similar to adenosine, it just has a different base on it, but it still has three phosphates. It carries high energy, just like ATP does. Okay, so here we see that GTP, and it bound to the alpha subunit. This is what we call the activated state of this receptor G protein complex. It has to have this energy molecule, which is a modified ATP, but it's called GTP. When that happens, these things can start to move around on the inside surface of the membrane. It just starts to move around by diffusion. It doesn't get released to the cytoplasm, right? It just stays right on the inside surface of the membrane. And when it's wandering around, it can bump into other proteins that are put into the membrane. And these other proteins here, we're going to call effectors. All right, what do you know about an effector? What's an effector? What does an effector do? It always produces a response. Yeah, effector produces response. So when these separated dissociated G proteins bump into an effector, it produces a response. So what could that response be? Not shown on this slide. Almost a little bit complicated to talk about it right now, but I think I will. A good example of an effector could be an enzyme. So there can be enzymes put in the cell membrane. And when these G proteins bump into that enzyme, it can turn the enzyme off or it can turn it on. It can go either way. In either case, if that enzyme state changes, it's going to change the physiology inside the cell. It's going to change the chemistry inside the cell. Another example of an effector could be an ion channel. And that ion channel could open up or it could close. So it can change how ions move across the membrane. And that's going to change the membrane potential inside the cell and eventually change the physiology inside the cell as well. Okay. And then after it bumps into these effectors that produce some kind of response, right, they dissociate from the effectors and they recombine back here on the receptor. And when that happens, GDP is hydrolyzed and inorganic phosphate is released. Right, so this is it requires energy. But once that PI is released, we call that the unstimulated state. The last thing that has to happen is that this GDP molecule has to be released by the alpha subunit. But remember, this GTP is held in there by a receptor site, or sometimes we call that an active site. And when GDP leaves, guess what can happen? There's a spot for GTP to bind to that location. So GDP goes away, GTP enters, and now this receptor G protein complex can listen for another signal from outside the cell. And if it does bind, what happens? Well, then there's dissociation once again. These things can bump into effectors, producing different kinds of responses. And this cycle can go over and over and over again. Okay, so in this particular case, you see something that's always trapped outside the cell. You see something always outside the cell? Do you see anything that's always inside the cell? Do you see something that's always inside the cell? Tell me what you see always inside the cell. What about this alpha subunit? Is it always inside or outside? It's always inside the cell. What about this beta and gamma subunit? Does it go inside and outside, or is it always outside or always inside? It's always inside. What did we call something that's always inside the cell? That is second messenger, right? So the G protein is a second messenger, right? These activated subunits right here are produced when this regulatory molecule, which is always outside the cell, what is something that is always outside the cell? First messenger, right? So regulatory molecule is first messenger, G protein is second messenger, and the second messengers are able to operate and turn on effectors when a first messenger binds to this receptor. And then that information goes across the cell membrane, even though this regulatory molecule, the first messenger, can't get across because it is hydrophilic. It can't get across the cell membrane. And a bunch of people won Nobel Prizes for figuring that out. You don't have to read about that, because not a history class, but it took a long time. Okay, this G protein coupled receptor complex, this is sort of interesting, okay, is highly conserved through evolution. That just means that this receptor, right, looks almost exactly the same in you and your brother, you and your sister, but that's not all. It's almost the same in you and your brother and snakes, you and your brother and insects, you and your brother and fish, and even very simple forms of life use this scheme, okay, to allow for signal transduction to take place. So this is used basically in all life forms, and that's pretty amazing to find some kind of something that's so specific that we find in all living life. And so what is that an example of? It could be an example of, or it supports what kind of theory? It's a support for evolution, right? So very early on, before there were humans, there were very simple organisms that found this particular kind of scheme to be very useful. And then the next higher level of organization or organism said, well, gee whiz, it works so well, why don't I use it too? Right? It's beneficial. It makes me compete in my environment. And then the next higher level that evolved said, oh, well, this G protein complex works really well. I don't have to invent anything else for signal transduction. And it was just passed from one life form to another and another through evolutionary processes. Right? It's not proof of evolution, but it certainly supports evolution, right? It doesn't contradict what we know to be evolution. So that's what we mean by this receptor is highly conserved. And that's probably the reason why it uses GTP instead of ATP, because ATP is a relatively new kind of molecule in terms of evolution. GTP is much older. And so it works with this older system. Okay, and it works fantastic, so nothing had to change. So this is an exam figure. So know that this is the activated state. When GTP binds to the G protein, it becomes activated, which means it can dissociate and the subunits can wander around on the membrane, and it can change these effectors. They can turn them on, turn them off. It could be an ion channel or an enzyme, and then that's going to produce a response. As the response is produced, or after response is produced, the subunits come back together again, and that cycle can repeat. The GDP comes off, another GTP comes on, and when the ligand, this little molecule, binds to the receptor, now you have an activated G protein, and you should see that G protein to be a second messenger. And the first messenger is always outside the cell. Right? And you should know some of the physical chemical properties of this first messenger. Like what's an important physical chemistry property of this first messenger? Round. Yeah, it's round. But I'm thinking in terms of chemistry, not just the shape, but where this thing likes to go. It's either hydrophilic or hydrophobic, is what I was thinking. That's a physical chemical property of this molecule. So you know that it is hydrophilic, and as because of that, it can't get through the cell membrane. And that's why it's a first messenger. Yeah. GTP, yes, for this one, it's easy because that's how they named it a G protein, because it uses GTP. And there's only a couple systems that use GTP in our bodies. Most use ATP as an energy source. So it's not too complicated. Okay, so this G protein certainly is what? The second messenger that changes, that produces a response by activating these effectors right here. Okay, so that's chapter number 6. Is there another chapter on the test? Oh, when did I say, when is the test? Week and a half from today. Oh, I have it right here someplace. Yeah, let me get my screen back. Okay, so today we said was the 11th, and indeed we're done with chapter 6, and we got a couple lectures on chapter 3. All right, so let's see, we go until what time? 12:45? Something like that? Okay, well, let's spend maybe 5 minutes looking at chapter 3 to get oriented, because I know you guys are going to spend some time on chapter 3 this weekend coming up. So if you're a little familiar with chapter 3 before you start reading and looking on the internet, I think that would be a good thing. All right. Okay, so chapter 3. Okay, cell structure, genetic control. A lot of this chapter is a review from anatomy, and you'll be really happy about that. That would be just a little small departure from anatomy when we get into genetic control. But cell structure you are probably really familiar with. So first, okay, if we want to study something about a cell, or if we want to study any kind of complicated topic, we'd like to break it down into smaller pieces, right? And then add all those smaller pieces together to understand what the big complicated piece is. And so what are the things that are necessary to build a cell? What's the building block of a cell? I don't know if we went over that. In anatomy, you did learn that. The building block of a cell is an organelle, right? And what's the building block of an organelle? It is chemicals. It's molecules, right? So, and if you take a bunch of cells, put them together, and if those cells all are the same shape, which means they have the same function, what does that produce? If you have cells all that are doing all the same thing, they all have the same shape, you're really close, that is called a tissue. It's called a tissue, right? And then if you take two different tissues to put them together, right, so it will do different kinds of things, that's what we call an organ. Like your heart is an organ because it has muscle tissue, it has nervous tissue, right? It has connective tissue in it. So that is a really good example of an organ. All right, so we're going to start with the building blocks of cells. And the first one to think about, we've kind of talked about it already, is the cell membrane. So I'm sure this is an exam figure right here, just a cell. I'm sure it was an important figure in your anatomy class. So you should recognize all of these building blocks, and we know them to be organelles, right, by their shape. But by their shape, you should also know what their function is, because this is physiology. So for instance, if on the test I have a lead line pointing to this thing, I think it's very easy for you to see this as being a mitochondria, but that won't be one of the choices on the test. What would be an answer on the test? It would be the function, and the function would be make ATP. Okay. And for instance, if there is an arrow pointing to, oh, I didn't turn my arrow on. Okay, pointing to this thing. This is, can you see that to be rough endoplasmic reticulum? That won't be an answer on the test. What would be a good answer? Okay, it does have ribosomes on it. Sorry, let me get my arrow back. Okay. It does have ribosomes, right? But I see free ribosomes over here in the cytosol, here and here and here. That endoplasmic reticulum does have the function of these ribosomes because there are ribosomes on that membrane. So rough endoplasmic reticulum functions for protein synthesis. It can make proteins. These ribosomes over here in the cytosol can make proteins as well. So it's a ribosome. So if I have an arrow pointing to this ribosome, what's the function of you, and what would be an answer on the test if I'm pointing to this thing right here? Would ribosome be an answer?
No.
It would not. You would have to know the function, which is protein synthesis, right? That's the workbench where proteins are made. And because this endoplasmic reticulum has ribosomes on it, that's what its function is as well, protein synthesis. Maybe I could think of another one. What about smooth endoplasmic reticulum? There's an arrow pointing here. Would smooth endoplasmic reticulum, would that be an answer?
No.
What would be a good answer? A good answer would be lipid synthesis, not protein synthesis. Why not protein synthesis? Because?
There's no
ribosomes on there. Okay. Another thing that the smooth endoplasmic reticulum does, and we just barely begin to talk about that, is that it's a storage place for calcium. All right, so there are proteins in the membrane of some endoplasmic reticulums that can take calcium from low concentration, which we said was almost zero in the cytosol, and put it into high concentration inside the smooth endoplasmic reticulum. What do we call that process going from low to high? Diffusion is high to low. I might have to draw something on the board for that. Active transport. And what does that would be ATP. So putting all the calcium inside here, it requires is primary active transport. Another reason why you need ATP. Okay, let me draw something on the board so that you never, ever mix up high concentration to low. Okay, when I was in college, all right, I had an MGB. Anybody know what an MGB is? No, probably not, because it's way too old. It's a car, and it was a little car, right? It was produced in England, and I didn't have any money to really fix it up, so a lot of times the battery was dead. I get out of school, get out of work, battery is dead, need the battery to start the engine, right? Sometimes the starter motor was out, so even if I had a battery, I couldn't crank the engine over to get the engine started. So what would I always do? So here's my little MGB car right here, and I would park it on top of a hill. And it was a really little car, and it had a manual transmission. I don't know if you guys know what manual transmission. Who knows what a manual transmission is? All right. So I had a manual transmission, which means that I could put it into neutral and get my left leg out of the car, get a little kick, right, get it over the edge right here, and it was a little dinky car. And what would happen to this car? It would start going down the hill. Does it go down the hill? Does it go from high to low all by itself? Do I need gasoline? Do I need ATP to get it from high to low? No. Okay, so that would be a passive process. Right? And then what I would do with this process, once it got going, it would be in first gear, I'd pop the clutch, that would turn the engine over, and I could go home because that would start the engine. I'm probably not the only person that has done that in here. Probably not. All right, so that's passive. Right, high to low. An example of a passive process is what? Diffusion. All right, now what about, how did I get on top of this hill? I had to start here and go up. What kind of process is that? Is that active or passive? That's active, right? I need gasoline to do that. So this thing here is active for my car. I needed gas, but for most processes in you, you don't have gasoline, you have ATP. Okay. And if this process uses ATP, what do we call that? Primary active transport. If it uses some other kind of energy, then we call that secondary active transport. So remember, diffusion always is high to low. Low to high is active. So it's easy for me to remember. If you have a hard time with that, I'll loan you my car. Okay, so yeah, I'm getting lectures online.